This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Priest Works Independent Community Radio. Okay, so last week, there was an update on Candace King's rent strike. They're basically starting a tenants union and starting a co-op for the land trust of interested people and tenants that would benefit and invest their lives and livelihoods into the co-op. So, and then I followed that with a thing on Billionaire's Row. And when I was looking at, I put that on there to compare Candace King with Billionaire's Row, because this is where real estate investment goes, is to empty buildings that just become a tax haven. And it's because our laws, because we have a state-sponsored corporatism in the United States, and we sponsor the rich and multinational corporations, and that's how we get into these things, and that's what this show is about. So, in researching Billionaire's Row, and so today, I found a thing on land trusts that explains basically land trusts, but also puts it in the perspective of reparations for blacks, because land reform is the most important way to road to social justice. Is you want to start with land reform. You want to get the peasants and the proletariats and the people in control of the land and therefore their own welfare and basic necessities. So I digress. So when I was researching this Billionaire's Row thing a little bit, I remembered, as I said last week, that now I remember what it was insurance companies were investing in New York real estate because they had no place to put their money. So in researching that, I found this article on where they used to put their money was in public housing. And now they and other elite, the 1%, invest in empty New York skylines. But think about it. I was just looking, you know, a bank has to keep 10% reserves. And so I was just researching this. Apparently, an insurance company only has to keep 12% reserves, which, think about it, are they really expecting to pay out a claim where they only have to keep 12% of their total assets in reserves? Now, of course, there would be several different, they're insuring a lot of different types of things, a broad spectrum of things. So you wouldn't pay out all your stuff at once, to be fair. But yeah, they only have to keep, so where do you put that 12%? You don't want to just leave that sitting somewhere. You want to invest it in a hard asset that pays you back money. So that's what they were, that's why they were investing in empty New York skyline buildings back in the 80s and 90s. But before that, they were investing in public housing. So, and it was to their advantage. One of the things that we're saying is it's to your own advantage. Corporations are supposed to work for the community. And the reason they are is because it's a cycle. You pay people enough so that they can afford to buy your products. If you believe, I'm not defending capitalism or anything, but that's the way it was supposed to work. They don't even, and part of the thing that I do on this show is I show that the capitalists don't even follow their own rules. All right, so this is the abstract from a Harvard paper from 2017 about where the largest pool of money was invested, which was insurance companies investing in public housing, and it was a safe investment for them because these were the people that would then buy insurance and work to keep their houses so they wouldn't have to pay out a claim. So that if the economy is working well, the things are maintained properly, insurance companies don't have to pay out claims. So this is the kind of devil's relationship we have with insurance companies. They actually do create safer and lower prices if they're done, if it's done right. But they make an obscene amount of money with relatively low risk because they understand all the risks before they start an insurance policy. Okay, so yeah, this is from the Harvard extract, and then got a little update on Thacker Pass, and then, as I say, land trusts as a means of reparations. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. Okay, so this is from the Harvard Joint Center for Housing Studies. So not exactly a liberal, Harvard is not a liberal source, you know, purposely. But please use your own brain at all times and research this stuff yourself. This is Adam Tanaka, PhD candidate, urban planning, Harvard University, Meyer Fellow, 2015, JCHS. This is from Working Paper, April 2017. All right, this is just the abstract. For a brief window between the late 1930s and the late 1940s, life insurance companies built approximately 50,000 middle-income rental apartments across the United States. At the time, life insurers controlled the largest pool of capital funds in the nation and believed that large-scale housing offered a secure and profitable investment, as well as good publicity for the industry. Most projects took the form of large-scale, racially segregated complexes, often with their own private streets, parks, and playgrounds. Most were also market rate, though economies of scale in financing and construction produced relatively affordable prices. While the volume of life insurance housing soon paled in the face of post-war suburban boom, built for much of the same demographic and often financed by life insurance dollars, life insurers' brief venture into multifamily development represents a significant and understudied episode in the history of affordable housing. This corporatized community development model represented a short-lived third way between public housing and the suburban home, the primary levers of post-war federal housing policy. This paper provides an overview of the rise and fall of life insurance housing with a focus on New York City, where the majority of insurance-sponsored apartments were located. The paper argues that when it came to middle-income urban housing, the 1940s represented a moment of unusual convergence between corporate need and municipal interests. While incentives were aligned, tens of thousands of relatively low-cost apartments were built in America's most expensive housing market, mixed-use and transit-oriented, decades before the terms gained currency. These projects proved a panacea for white families who earned too much for public housing but not enough to purchase suburban homes. As soon as civic and corporate needs began to diverge, however, insurance capital shifted towards the suburban mortgage market, which offered higher returns with fewer political obstacles. In the context of today's continued shortage of affordable housing, particularly for middle-income renters in high-cost cities, a group underserved by federal subsidies, the story of life insurance housing can be read as both a cautionary tale of corporate hubris and a missed opportunity to tap deep-pocketed fiduciary funds for large-scale, low-cost housing. All right, so that's what I'm saying, too, is that even in a capitalist system, again, I'm not defending this, you're supposed to pay workers enough to be able to buy your products. Instead, what we have is a corporate system where they extract from the cycle, and you're basically paying the same way you pay a real estate broker. You're basically paying the rentier class for basically doing, and the financial class for doing nothing. And that's where all your money goes. Not to mention the wars, the unnecessary wars with the wrong countries that we've had throughout the 20th century, where your tax dollars, instead of going, whether you believe in this or not, whether you believe in social welfare, privatized social welfare or public social welfare or not, your dollars, your tax dollars are blown up with bombs instead of being used to create highways and infrastructure and health care and child care and things like that that would make your own cost of living go down because you wouldn't have to pay for those things. Whether you believe in that or not, that's where your money has gone, to wars and to the 1% have extracted all this money for all this stuff that is going on, all this trading and business and life that goes on. They're just basically skimming money off the top and doing nothing, almost nothing for it, at virtually no risk. So none of which is capitalism, whether you believe in capitalism or not. It's supposed to take a risk, and then that's how you gain your gains. The more risk you take, the higher your gains. And just an aside to institutional investors would be, if you invest in the stock market long term, I think it's something like 16%. The stock market averages about 16% a year that it will grow. So institutional investors could be investing in new appropriate technology that is a little bit risky, but if they took it long term, they could transfer, they could get out of oil, the standby things that they've been investing in that they think are safe. They could take a risk and not lose all our money. You don't have to park. You can't park your money, first of all, because that is not beneficial to society. But you wouldn't have to park your money. There's plenty of investment opportunity in alternatives. And the sooner they do this, the better. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Up next, how land trusts can be a vehicle for reparations for blacks and other oppressed minorities that the United States has oppressed. And I've got a quick update on Thacker Pass. All right, so this is from protectthackerpass.org. A group of seven water protectors sued by a mining company for peacefully protesting the Thacker Pass lithium mine in Nevada have asked a state court to dismiss their case. Their brief, filed on Friday, argues that the protesters were exercising their First Amendment rights to peaceful assembly. Quote, as a sacred site is being bulldozed, nonviolent protesters are being criminalized by a foreign mining company, says attorney Terry Lodge, who is representing the defendants. My clients were engaged in protest that is clearly protected by the U.S. Constitution. This is corporate greed and bullying. Analysts say the lawsuit is similar to what is called a strategic lawsuit against public participation, or SLAPP suit, aimed at shutting down constitutionally protected free speech and protest. It aims to ban the water protectors from the area and force them to pay monetary damages. The suit was filed in late May following a month of nonviolent protests on the site of the lithium mine in northern Nevada. Thacker Pass is known as Pihimuha in Paiute and is a sacred site to regional Native American tribes. It's also habitat for threatened and endangered wildlife. Our ancestors fought and died for the land at Pihimuha, says Dean Barlees, an elder and spiritual leader from the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe who is one of the defendants in the case. We've acted for the coming generations to protect Mother Earth. On September 12, 1865, federal soldiers murdered at least 31 Paiute men, women, and children in Thacker Pass during the Snake War. Several of the defendants in the case are descended from people who were killed in 1865, including Doris Sam, whose ancestor, Ox Sam, escaped the cavalry raid by riding his horse through Thacker Pass. We took action to protect the land, air, and water for our future generations, says Sam, who is a member of the Fort McDermott Paiute Shoshone tribe and the leader of the Native American Church of the State of Nevada. Pihimuha is part of the history and future of our people, but what will that future look like now? This massacre and other culturally important factors have made the Thacker Pass mine extremely controversial in the Native American community. Dozens of tribes have spoken out against the project, with four going to court. One lawsuit filed by the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, Summit Lake Paiute Tribe, and Burns Paiute Tribe early this year is still battling in court to stop the Thacker Pass mine. The National Congress of American Indians has also passed several resolutions opposing the project. But despite ongoing criticism, lawsuits, and lobbying from tribes as well as environmental groups, ranchers, the Nevada State Historic Preservation Society, and the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation, both Lithium Nevada Corporation and the Bureau of Land Management have refused to stop construction or change any aspect of the Thacker Pass mine. In February, the Bureau of Land Management recognized Thacker Pass as eligible for the National Register of Historic Places as a traditional cultural district or a landscape that's very important to tribes. But the very day before, they issued Lithium Nevada's final bond, allowing the Canadian multinational to begin full-scale mining operations. With mine construction beginning, protesters were left with no option other than to exercise their right to petition the government by protesting peacefully, which led to the lawsuit. The defendants in the lawsuit are charged with civil conspiracy, nuisance, trespass, tortious interference with contractual relations, tortious interference with prospective economic advantage, and unjust enrichment. These allegations are alarming to the Great Basin Native American communities who believe their religious practices are protected by the American Indian Religious Freedom Act of 1978. The lawsuit's language places fear in the hearts of Native American people who want to pray and visit their ancestors' grave sites, and in those of the ecologists, naturalists, and environmentalists who hope to protect the critical habitat at Thacker Pass from destruction. The motion filed on Friday argues that Lithium Nevada Corporation failed to provide any evidence of their claims that the protesters' actions included violence and constituted conspiracy. It also states that the defendants are outcome-oriented and protested at Thacker Pass with the intention to influence government law and regulation. Lithium Nevada, a mining corporation benefited from the violence used to conquer Native peoples, is trying to bully peaceful protesters opposing the destruction of that massacre site, said Will Falk, an attorney and one of the defendants in the case. People need to understand that lithium mining companies like coal or gold mining companies use racist and violent tactics to intimidate opposition. It is truly outrageous that we live in a society where our Supreme Court has granted constitutional rights to resource extraction corporations, making their destructive activities fully legal and virtually immune from oversight by we the people. Even their right to sue us is a corporate personhood right, said defendant Paul Cienfuegos, founding director of Community Rights U.S. Max Wilbert, another defendant in the case, says lithium mining for electric vehicles and batteries isn't green, it's greenwashing. It's not green, it's greed. Terry Lodge said the protesters took a moral stand in the form of civil disobedience. They are being unjustly targeted with sweeping charges that have little relationship to the truth, and we will vigorously defend them. All right, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Up next, land trusts as a means for reparations. And please support independent media. The Springfield Eugene Tenant Association hotline is partially open. As of August 24th, 2023, we are now able to respond back to priority calls within 5 to 7 business days, which include calls about evictions, rent assistance, and or violence against tenants. While we still can accept calls about other topics, we unfortunately cannot guarantee a speedy return callback at this time. The hotline number is 541-972-3715. 541-972-3715. If you're seeking information about your tenancy, we encourage you to see our resources guide on our website at www.springfieldeugenetenantsassociation.com/renters_rights. That's at the Springfield Eugene Tenant Association.com website. We've made this decision to slowly reopen our hotline to give our new hotline team the chance to train and learn about their roles in a healthy, not rushed environment. We're also using this time to review our hotline procedures to provide more flexibility, outreach, and support to our community. We do not plan to be half open for long. We are committed to bringing our hotline back in full force as soon as we can, but want to be intentional in our commitment to having a safe and healthy working environment. Our priority is to ensure that our community feels safe, supported, and informed on what their rights are, and that includes our own team. We also want to give a special thank you to those in our community who continually help share our message and our resources to those most in need. Your help in carrying our voice has a much bigger impact than you know. We appreciate your support and patience as we take this next step. Thank you in solidarity, the Springfield Eugene Tenants Association team. The people of Beaver Creek Watershed are gearing up to take on a behemoth in the fight of their lives. News spread like wildfire after a handful of members in this tightly knit community were notified of the plan to aerial spray 473 acres of clear-cut forest over the Beaver Creek Watershed in Lincoln County with a deadly chemical cocktail containing glyphosate, also known as Roundup, as well as several other chemicals. As word got out to the neighbors of Beaver Creek and the surrounding community, within days, there was activation on every conceivable front with hundreds of separate individuals working to stop the spray and poisoning of the water. A petition with the details and informative links urging Governor Tina Kotek to put a moratorium on the spray operation reached 2,000 signatures in about 2 weeks. The quick public outcry was inspiring and continues to build momentum. Word of mouth, social media, neighborhood community meetings, and education prompted about 100 public comments to be sent to the Oregon Department of Forestry explaining the reasons They do not want their watershed to be sprayed against their will, the most comments the Toledo Department has ever received by far. This is no new fight to Lincoln County, where there have been several waves of community members fighting the aerial spray and subsequent drift, and its dangers since the 70s. Knowing the chemicals have been shown to cause multiple types of cancer and are subject to upwards of 100,000 lawsuits against Monsanto/Bayer, the community has no choice but to band together and stand up for their health and the well-being of the entire wetland ecosystem. The legislation must be changed. Protecting their homes, families, animals, water, and children isn't the only concern for the residents of this small coastal town. The Creek Valley is teeming with abundant life from a lush variety of native wetland plants, birds, and fish, including the federally protected coho salmon and marbled murrelet, to beaver, river otter, and the majestic roaming elk herds. Beaver Creek is also a protected state natural area where families have come to paddle and kayak for years, as well as walk along the state park marshlands and enjoy hikes. Lastly, Seal Rock Water District has its main intake about 1 mile from the proposed sprays and supplies water to all of its approximately 5,500 residents. Needless to say, SRWD is in quite an uproar about it and has been vocal in the battle by saying that they will do everything they can to not be giving the contaminated water to their customers. The question is whether the people who live in Beaver Creek and downstream have a right to decide what goes into the water they drink, or if a private landowner whose home address is in Denmark, where these chemicals are illegal, can legally poison the land and water, negatively affecting thousands and destroying critical species habitat with no repercussions. So many have been asking, how is this even legal? The community response seems to be, we don't know, but we're about to change it. The citizens of Seal Rock Water District and the neighbors of Beaver Creek Basin are choosing to stand up and fight against this atrocity. The health of so many families and lives in these invaluable wetland areas are at risk of serious permanent and accumulative damage that it's impossible to just sit back and watch, and they need your help. You can go to their GoFundMe site, Save Beaver Creek, GoFundMe Save Beaver Creek, or you can get more information at stopthespray.com.
400 years since the first enslaved Africans arrived in Jamestown, many people agree that reparations are due, but what would that look like? How about affordable property in black hands in perpetuity? Could community land trusts be a way of making repair? A lawyer, a policy advocate, and an organizer with homeless New Yorkers talk about what's possible and what's happening. Next, on the Laura Flanders Show, the place where the people who say it can't be done take a back seat to the people who are doing it. Welcome.
Every year for 30 years, Representative John Conyers introduced a bill calling for the U.S. government to study providing reparations to African Americans for slavery. Congress hasn't acted yet. But this year has already seen more Democrats talking about reparations than ever, including several running for the presidency. Now, rather than writing checks to individuals, more and more people are talking about collective strategies for repair and reparation. Community land trusts, cooperatives, and mutual housing associations, for example, might offer a way to transfer some long-promised land and rights to America's black communities while making today's housing economy less speculative. Do land trusts actually model a doable way of repairing the damage of the past while simultaneously creating a more equitable economy going forward? Just possibly. Joining us to discuss those possibilities are Catherine Franke. She's the author of a new book, Repair, Redeeming the Promise of Abolition. Kathy Albisa, co-founder and executive director of NESRI, that's the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. And Jaritza Geigel, she's a senior organizer for Picture the Homeless, a grassroots organization founded and led by homeless people, which advocates for social justice on issues like housing and what they call the shelter industrial complex. Welcome, everybody. So glad to have you. Let's start with a little history. I hate to do this to you, Catherine, but, you know, people don't know the history. They don't get taught it. So when we're talking about repair, when we're talking about reparations for slavery, some might say, well, wasn't there Reconstruction? Didn't slavery end?
Well, in your middle school social studies class or your history class, you get the story of we fought a civil war over slavery, the slaves were freed, there was Reconstruction that sort of rebuilt the economy of the South, and then here we are today, and that's all that was owed. But what actually happened is that people were emancipated, were freed from slavery, into a condition of abject poverty, into a kind of world where white supremacy and violent racism still structured their lives. And part of what I wanted to do with repair is return to that history and illuminate the ways in which even Northern military officials saw it as necessary to provide reparations in the form of land to freed people, both as a way to recognize the horrible torture, theft, rape, death, separation of families that structured slavery, but also to make freedom a reality, a practical reality, for freed people to have some resources as they began and rebuilt free lives. Mm. So we've done it. We've done it in this country, but we don't know it. So part of what the book is about, designed to do, is repair that history, is to bring us back to that period and see that this was doable then, and it was seen as necessary to what it meant to emancipate freed people.
Now, Jerry, to you, I mean, you work with people that are dealing with very urgent needs and concerns. Does this history resonate? Does it have life today?
Absolutely. I look ambiguous, but being a Black young woman myself and understanding my heritage and my ancestry and where it all leads to, we're living in, you know, modern day colonial times of what people being displaced or actually land being stolen and continue to be occupied this day by the descendants of European settlers look like and the impact of that, right? So I'm now in Bushwick that has been gentrified for over the last 20 years, and any month now you can be priced out. I've had to watch many family members move out of the neighborhoods, go to surrounding like Jersey City to try to go to more affordable places. And then you're even beginning to see those surrounding areas in the tri-state beginning to become even more priced out because of gentrification and how folks are continuously being displaced and then entering either the streets and trying to survive that or enter the shelter industrial complex that really is, it's not a home and it hasn't really guaranteed any real sustainable pathway for folks getting out of shelter and back into permanent housing for folks and let alone have ownership over those homes.
I mean, I'm hearing a lot of resonance here. Kathy, I mean, your organization recently released something called the New Social Contract that knits together a picture of the future that could be different. But how do you connect to this history?
What I'd like to start with was some of the concepts that struck me most powerfully in Catherine's book, because I was really excited as I was reading it. Part one prong of our new social contract work is land, housing, and natural resources. And we work with Picture the Homeless on some of these issues, really advancing the notion of community control and collective ownership of land. And for those who don't know, a community land trust is land that is owned collectively, but the houses are owned individually by families. And so they are building equity, you are building wealth, but you're doing so outside of the speculative economy. There is a contract, there's an agreement amongst all the neighbors, residents, the community land trust, to keep the housing permanently affordable. This is what prevents the ongoing displacement that you were describing. Now, what struck me about Catherine's book, because I was reading two concepts that, for me, knitted together why this is such a powerful conversation and how important it is now in order to really rethink how we talk about land, housing, and even natural resources. Catherine talked about recovering possible futures. Mm. The idea that there were people, even then, who knew this was the right thing to do, to give reparations, to give it in a concrete form of land. The land people had been working for years, if not generations. And it was abruptly cut off, right? It was abruptly cut off by the white supremacy that pushed us off that path. And in to recover that possible future, the other concept she talks about in the book is we need to understand the difference between history and memory. Mm. So we've relegated it to history, but we haven't really embedded it in our cultural memory. Mm. So how can you fix something if you have collective amnesia and you refuse to face it? So excavating and recovering this memory, making it part, you know, making our history and our memory whole again, allows us to think about this model in a real way. It would be really wonderful as a form of reparations, but it would actually be good, as most things are that are just, for the entire country.
Yeah. So let me come back to you, Catherine. I mean, if people do have a memory, they have a memory that people were intending to do something along the lines of repair and were stopped, as Kathy just said. This didn't happen.
Well, it actually did in the Sea Islands area, and then in another area just outside of Vicksburg. Land was seized from the Confederate plantation owners when they fled. So that land was seized, and then it was explicitly and intentionally reallocated to freed people in 40-acre units, which is where we get that term today of 40 acres and a mule, with the understanding that this is how you'll begin your new lives on this land. And actually, the general's order that allowed for those allocations barred white people from entering those communities. And the idea was, you people need to heal. And you're going to heal and empower yourselves separate from white people. And it was a beautiful and exciting idea. But as soon as Lincoln was assassinated, the new president came in, took all that land back, and gave it to the former slave owners, and then required that free people enter into year-long labor contracts with the people who had owned them before. So they reinstituted a form of legalized slavery just under another name.
With the black codes.
With the black codes and all of that. So, you know, as Michelle Alexander talks about the new Jim Crow, this is the seeds of that were taking place in the immediate post-war period. But for a little window of time, there was a whole nother model.
Now, that window did extend in certain parts of the country with the growth of black towns that were pretty successful until massive white backlash and white supremacist violence moving right through to the 1920s, even 50s.
Absolutely. There were a few towns, largely African-American towns of freed people, sort of peppered through the South, but by and large, those communities of black people were driven out through lynching, from just, you know, straight up murder with a gun, through just terror, racial terror that took place in what we think is this period of wonderful Reconstruction. It actually was a period of racial terror that drove what we understand to be the Great Migration of formerly enslaved people, African Americans, to the North, to being locked into multi-generations of real poverty. So if people had had land, had had the ability to build firm economic lives in the immediate post-war period, we would see the economy in a very different racially stratified way today. And what we've done instead is lock people into the sort of permanent condition of poverty, which, because we haven't acknowledged this collective responsibility, we individualize it as if it's each black person's fault.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about those two models that are central to your story, the Sea Islands in South Carolina, and is it Davis Bend?
Davis Bend. So Jefferson Davis, who was the president of the Confederacy, he and his brother owned a huge plantation right outside of Vicksburg. And as soon as General Grant moved into that area with the Northern troops and all of the white people, the Confederates had to leave, black people took over. They ran the plantations. They were allocated land. It was explicitly understood that this would be a kind of black haven, a haven of an experiment in freedom. Similar thing took place in the Sea Islands. All of the white people fled when the Northern troops came in, and the Northern military saw a kind of human horror that shook them to their core by facing what slavery looked like, the kind of condition that the enslaved people presented themselves to the Northern military, sick, hungry, with no clothing. And they were so incredibly moved that we have to do something to repair this situation. It implicates us. Mere emancipation is not enough. And so 40-acre plots of land were allocated to families. And what's really interesting is that folks tended to live in collective units, not just nuclear families, because that's how they had been living before, and also the way that slavery split families up. There were complicated kinship relationships, multiple parents.
Survival strategies, too.
Absolutely. And so the idea that we would today return to that idea of collective community ownership reflects also what was going on in that period.
I mean, it's hard, Jari, not to think of the what-ifs. Are there what-ifs running through your head as you hear these stories? And did you know them? I didn't know them.
there are no what ifs that were to my story. Like, this is, this, you know, going back to when, as you were saying, right, when Black farmers in the South really kind of like started this whole thought process of community living and community, like land trust, if you want to think about it. This goes back to Native Indigenous practices, where our thought and the way we viewed land, it was like this collective ownership where we could all live and be prosperous and have long-term sustainability. So for me, it's like, it's not a dream. It's not something that's too far out of reach. This is something that is possible. This is one out of many tools that our communities can benefit from. And people across the country have been, this is not a new concept, people across the country are using this form as a way to, you know, maintain affordable ways of living right now.
Kathy, you wanted to come in on this?
I do, because I think the other thing that it should cause us to think about is sort of interrogate what we think of as freedom. Yeah. You make a distinction in the book between being free and being freed.
Yeah.
So people were freed, but they weren't free. And none of us are free right now, right? Not in this economy and not in this political system. The collectivity that was being practiced in those two spaces, the CN Islands and Davis Bend, that was a form of being free, not just freed. Mm-hmm. And the collectivity we can practice today, you had mentioned our new social contract project, if you look at all five prongs, it's a way of acting collectively so we can actually be free. Right. And we need to understand, not only is there no contradiction between that, it is, one is absolutely impossible without the other.
Catherine, to you, I mean, it's beautiful what Kathy is doing here, but I can't help thinking, and we'll come back to you on this too, Kathy, of course, there was a white supremacist backlash then. This feels like a white supremacist revival moment now. What makes you think this conversation is ripe for this second?
Well, we've never experienced a period where white supremacy didn't structure our political, economic, legal lives. What I find surprising, and I certainly didn't think this as I was writing the book, or starting to write the book 10 years ago, is that the issue of reparations is actually a legitimate conversation right now. You've noted there's been a bill introduced into Congress year after year after year, not to deliver reparations, but just to study it. And they couldn't even get a hearing on it. The bill is now getting a hearing. Every person who's running for president from the Democratic Party is talking seriously about reparations. Actually, if they don't have a position, they look like they're actually not with the program. So to say that white supremacists won't have a reaction to these proposals and to the serious consideration of reparations would be to ignore the power of white supremacy, but something has broken out here.
I've heard Elizabeth Warren, I've heard Kamala Harris. Bernie Sanders was terrible on this last time around, although I was a Bernie. I was very positively disposed to him generally, but he was terrible on this. Has he changed?
He's gotten better. You know, he's evolving on a lot of things that have to do with racial justice. It's not where his heart lies, I think. Economic justice in a way that doesn't figure racial justice as it, at its core, as I think of all our work does, is not really a comfortable place for him, but he's working on it. So he did describe reparations earlier as divisive. But he's walked that back, and he's now talking about it in a different way. And I have to say, the community land trust, the sort of collective ways of thinking property, have to figure in some important way in the way that we undertake reparations, but they aren't the only thing.
Sure.
Right? There are all sorts of, just knowing the history, museums, apology, other ways of taking down the statues around the country of Confederate heroes. To me, these are all part of an emerging collective reckoning with the enduring intergenerational injury of slavery.
But apology without action wouldn't be enough.
Right. No, apology without action wouldn't be enough. And action has to actually address the underlying structures, because our society, our economy, our politic is structured in a highly racialized way. Right? And it affects all people of color, but it is really, my opinion, centered around anti-blackness.
Yes.
And you know, we cannot leave out the project to wipe out indigenous people too, right? Those two grave kind of original sins are constantly in tension with what are really a set of beautiful ideals of equality, fraternity, liberty. And that has been our historic wrestling, right? How do we square that circle? And we cannot square it until we do what you're talking about, have a serious reckoning with it and engage it and respond to it, both on the level of narrative and on the level of structure.
But I also think it's essential that white people take responsibility for the advantages that we have been born into. So it's not only an issue of addressing the disadvantage that African-American people have had in this country, but the fact that we're seeing the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth taking place right now as the people of my parents' generation are dying, and we're dropping the estate tax so that that accumulated advantage, wealth, leg up, boots that you can have straps on that can actually pull your life up economically, is all built on the fact that there was property, there was economic advantage that was part of what it meant to be white in this country that we have to take responsibility for, which is why I recommend in the book that we raise the estate tax considerably, and we tax that what I think is a windfall for people like me, and use that money to fund what a substantial reparations project would look like.
I mean, it's often the case that our sort of civil rights accomplishments are measured in terms of wage and income improvements and shrinkage of the disparity in wage differentials. It's on this issue of wealth and property ownership and ability to make decisions around property and inheritance that you really see the legacy of slavery. Tell us some more about what's actually happening in East Harlem. I mean, there is a community land trust in the works. Talk about what's going on right here, right now. This isn't pie in the sky.
In 2017, through the enterprise grant that the city rolled out, like an RFP, a request for interest, and we won. We were one of the groups, but it was $1.6 million divided between three other organizations. And so $500,000 is a lot for one person if you're thinking about it, but it really is not enough. And so we were able to get two buildings, if I'm remembering correctly. We managed to own the land that it's on. And so what happened is we helped create a mutual housing association with residents, folks who we actually sit on the board. So there's two nonprofit organizations that sit on the board of it. And we also have electeds that can also be a part of the role. So we have all different stakeholders that are a part of it. And they make the collective decisions around what kind of repairs are needed, what are the financial fiscal responsibilities that we need, who are the professionals that we may need to be bringing on board who can actually help us move this work forward in an intentional way. And that's still in the works, right? One of the things that we need to be advocate more fund is that folks are going to need more financial support for these mutual housing associations to actually get a lot of the
work. Well, that's where some of those reparations might come in. Kathy?
Yeah, I just also wanted to point out that while community land trusts and other shared equity models are a very small slice of our housing in the country, there are 200 community land trusts around the country.
Yes.
And there have been some around for decades. And what's important to know about them is they work spectacularly well overall. When the foreclosure crisis hit, the community land trusts were barely touched. The foreclosure rate in community land trusts were very, very tiny. If you subsidize a family for buying a home in a community land trust, 90% of them are still in their private home 5 years later. If you subsidize a family to buy a home in the private market, only 50% are in their own home 5 years later. So we know the model works. This is not a theory. This is not an experiment. This is something that's been done for a long time. What we need is the political commitment to take land out of the speculative economy and create stability and thriving neighborhoods.
Well, it's happening in different communities in different ways. New York is, particularly Manhattan and Harlem, is a very dense place where gentrification sort of structures the real estate market entirely. So to hold back a couple of buildings is a big thing, but it may not be transformative in the community. But if you go to Jackson, Mississippi, where they're also experimenting a lot with community land trusts, what they're doing there, as in Detroit and other cities, where there are just vast parts of the city that have been abandoned, right? There are no services, there's no one living there, very few people living there. It's a way to recapture those communities. And not through gentrification, not through what you see in so many cities where they build a new downtown and then the yuppies come back from the suburbs and then all the folks who were living there have nowhere to go and end up in shelters. What you're doing is you're repairing the very idea of the city itself through community land ownership and community control, and rather than real estate developers who have no investment in the long-term health or culture of a city.
So how could our conversation, what you're calling for around the conversation, if only the conversation around reparations, but also the actual concrete money, how could that conversation shift change the reality on the ground? I'm thinking of Shirley Sherrod, the former ag secretary, who we had on the program a few years ago, talking about one of the first community land trusts in the United States that came out of the civil rights movement and that she was involved in Georgia. It's one of the largest in the South still. What they were up against on a daily basis from the Agriculture Department, from pretty much every agency of government at the national, regional, and local level, not to mention just vigilantes, was nothing ordinary. Could this conversation that you're engaging in shift in a way that actually made it safer and more doable for people on the ground?
I think so, because when these sorts of experiments take place on a kind of ad hoc basis here and there in the little cracks in a community, they're so vulnerable to the violence, the backlash of white supremacists or just speculators who often may be the same people in some communities. But when it's a national conversation or at least a larger community conversation about a deliberate effort to repair cities, repair communities, through what are, as Kathy Albisa explains, really tried and true experiments around collective land ownership, it provides a kind of safety, I think, for those experiments, not as just random ad hoc anomalies, but actually a new model of the city. You know, Hudson Yards is a great example of an enormous failure of the idea of a speculative real estate development project on steroids. Everyone in the city hates this new thing, this new sort of symbol of wealth. And it's a kind of, it's just an awful thing. And so the contrast to that are the kind of values that underwrite community land trusts.
Hudson Yards being a massive development on the west side of Manhattan that got a lot of city support and is really all about commerce with a little art thrown in. We have a practice that nowadays of saying, you know, what do you think is the story the future will tell of this moment? In a nutshell, what do you think? And then I'll come
to you.
Well,
I think the future is for us to write, right? They talk about the history bend towards justice, but it's not a law of physics, right? It depends on the kind of commitment and energy that we put into it. But I know the future people are working very hard to write. And in that future, we are sharing risk. It's income solidarity, it's risk solidarity, it's public responsibility to meet basic needs. It's collective community control, and it's really a new vision of democracy, where democracy is not just showing up at the ballot box, which not even that's working these days, but it's beyond the ballot box, right? It's democracy beyond elections, where people actually have agency to shape their lives, their institutions, and their country.
Echoing all that, and I agree. I think folks have had enough. The energy is there. I think the more we intentionally begin to really center, because I think you hit it on the nose, is that there's a lot of, like, it comes out of this anti-black narrative. And I think that the moment we begin to, as we continue, I want to say, really put black issues at the heart of all the issues that we're talking about, then we'll actually, like, see some changes begin to happen.
I want to thank you all. We're out of time, but this conversation will continue on this program, and you can find out more about all of the organizations represented on today's show and get a copy of the book for yourself at our website. That's lauraflanders.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
I'm waiting for the angels of Babylon, waiting for the eastern glow. The apples are in the valley's home, the seeds have been left. The crown is rich from tender care, repaid you not forget. The sun shines, the clouds are.